So hello, welcome to this week's Football Fans Podcast European Championships 2016 special.
I don't have sympathy for him because I feel he was lucky to go anyway. I think he definitely was lucky to be the one of two between him and Andros.
Politically, you know, we know they have the issues with the civil liberties, so they can't do the type of searches that we might be able to do in the UK or different parts. It's very difficult for them. So yeah, they probably did have just too many balls to juggle.
My biggest problem is we can have someone who's convicted of rape or sexual assault get a job in football, but not a woman who feels she was unfairly sacked from her job. Now that's a bigger problem to me.
You know, his goal ratio, his goal return is not that great. He always seems to take really nice shots and they're really close, like just whistle past the bar, but I never see them go in.
Thank you very much for joining the FFP this week. I mentioned on the last podcast that we will be doing a series of Euro specials during the summer. The last one went down pretty well with a lot of the listeners and people that got in touch. So thank you very much for the comments on that podcast. My name is Jordan and you can follow the Football Fans Podcast, as you should know by now. Football Fans Podcast, subscribe and share via the iTunes library. And follow us on Twitter, FFP_11. I'm joined this week by a couple of football fans. We have our Chelsea fan, Gabriel. How you doing, my friend?
I'm good this evening, huh? How you doing?
I'm good, mate. I'm all good. All good. And we have the returning Arsenal fan, Natasha.
Hi, Jordan. You're right.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm all right.
You've been missing. People have been tweeting
ghosted
in and asking, like, where you been?
I go away so you lot can realise how much you miss me.
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. Fair enough. I know a few other panellists that have expressed how much they've missed you on the Football Fans Podcast. So yeah, all good. Wicked. Let's get straight into it. No drive-bys this week on the pods. Gabriel, let's start with England talk. Let's start with both of you, actually. First of all, how well do you think England have done so far in the three games that we've seen from them?
I haven't been impressed with England at all. I think the football has been pretty similar to Man United, and that, I think that kind of says it all. With that being said, it's difficult to be too harsh because I don't think there's any team that has really kind of pulled up any trees. So I think as long as they've still got another round almost in the round of 16 where they'll probably get a bit of a bye. Because of the way this tournament has been set up, which is kind of, in my view, is kind of filtered out some of the quality and kind of watered it down slightly. So I still think the next round are probably relatively straightforward. If they can get themselves sorted out in that game and then kind of go into the next game firing, they might still have a chance to kind of maybe do something or progress in the tournament. But I still get that feeling that I get with every tournament, that as soon as we meet someone half decent, that we're on the plane home.
It's curtains. Natasha, what's been your synopsis of the three games so far? Do you agree with G that it's been a little bit underwhelming?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to disagree because no team's been great. I've had a lot of friends who are not as big football fans as we are saying to me, God, it's really boring, you know, because they're watching games and it's 1-0 or 2-0. And what you're getting is people being scared to concede, knowing that if they win 1-0, if they draw, they can still get through as the best third place team. So everyone's kind of being really nervous. So I do think now we will see people going out to win, to score three goals and not worrying about the one or two they're conceding. But I'm not really surprised by England. I think once you commit to playing Rooney in midfield, you then have to play the 4-3-3, you know, to fit him in or to make him comfortable. And then you kind of take away what is the strengths of Sturridge, Vardy and Kane. So if Roy wants to drop Rooney, we can do a 4-4-2 and see how it goes. But if he's going to play him, then that's what we're going to end up with.
So on that point, do you feel, I was wondering yesterday, all this Rooney talk, I mean, my views are that I wouldn't have taken him, but he's done okay, to be fair, in my view. But he'll be playing. Mm. On your kind of formation point there, I was wondering yesterday, is there any formation that you can play with an 11 that allows every player of that team to play in their strongest position? So take the back five, take them out of the equation because the fullbacks, centre-backs, that's cool. But the six in front, is there any formation you can think of that allows each player to play in their strongest position?
I don't think you can put each player individually into their strongest position, but you can put them in a situation where they can adapt within that. So if you are playing, like obviously Sturridge coming in off the left, we know he's not a winger, but if he's got the opportunity where someone can go and take his position on the left, that he can come in central, then that will work. But no, it does feel a bit like square pegs and round holes, but it always does with England because, you know, we take Rooney as a striker, but he's playing in midfield. But then we only take three centre-halves. Now, I'd rather you left Jack Wilshere at home, who, as an Arsenal fan, even I agree he shouldn't have gone. I'd rather you left him at home and take another defender than take a midfielder that's basically, we know he's not going to play because Rooney is always going to play before them. You know, it feels like a wasted position.
Gee, I know you're someone that agreed that Rooney should be on the plane and should be in the squad.
Yeah.
Do you feel, though, that there is any kind of formation you can play that allows every single player to play in their stronger position? Because I'm looking at other teams, and a lot of the top teams don't seem to have a problem in terms of playing the best players in their best position.
Most of them don't have strikers, though, do they? Not all of them have more than one out-and-out striker. They'll have a false nine, or they'll have someone who floats behind.
I've just watched the Germany-Northern Ireland game, and they seem to be playing most of their players in their strongest positions. So there's quality, arguably better players on the bench, but in terms of putting out an 11, do you feel it's possible to have... Basically, what I'm asking is it a lose-lose for Roy Hodgson? Because whatever formation he plays, someone's going to be out of position anyway. Or do you think that's not the way it has to be?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think... Well, I mean, the only formation that you would say that could possibly suit... Well, not everyone, because I don't think we have a suit formation to everyone, but maybe the majority would be a 4-4-2. But I don't think you win a tournament playing a 4-4-2. You get flooded in the midfield, you get beat. It might be good at certain points in the game, maybe if you're struggling like it was last night. But yeah, I don't think there is a formation. I think we've had the discussion before, going back to Natasha's point, I think kind of too much emphasis is being put on Rooney. And if Rooney was out, you know, there were formations that could, you know, suit England better. I just don't see that. I still think 4-3-3 is probably the halfway house between the best formation that suited to tournament football and to the players that we have. I don't think we've got a natural number 10. So I don't think Rooney is holding anyone back from doing that position. If anything, he's arguably, you know, him or Dele Alli, probably arguably the better number 10s that we have. And he's playing in central midfield at the moment, and he's doing as well as I think any of the other central midfielders. I'm not saying he's pulling up trees, I'm not playing, he's playing fantastically well, but he's doing as well. But he offers that leadership quality. I know you're not a big fan of it, you know. Natasha's kissing the teeth as well.
I did roll my eyes.
Yeah, I mean, bearing in mind, obviously, you both support Arsenal, so you don't really know what a real leader is.
No. Fair enough. We haven't had a real leader for several years, but I'm sorry. When England play badly, the first player that is out speaking to the media is always Joe Hart. It's not Rooney. I know he's not the most articulate of guys and he may not be comfortable, but you saw him in the press conference. He's already spiky before you even ask him one question. I don't feel I need to explain myself, but I'm going to sit here and explain myself. So no, I don't have respect for you as a leader. If he was a leader, Man U wouldn't have been playing as badly as they were last season.
Isn't that a little bit harsh? I mean, I've been digging out United, to be fair, all season. It's been quite fun. But isn't that a little bit harsh, bearing in mind?
No, because you look at Chelsea.
What he's got to work with at United.
But you look at Chelsea, and we all know if John Terry was still Jose's friend, they wouldn't have been playing as badly. That's what a leader is. A leader has that power to influence his teammates. Even if they're not liking the manager, if he's a leader, like Roy Keane would... Who was it that used to hate each other when they played up front together for Man United?
Sheringham and Cole.
Right. Yeah. So there was enough leaders within that team to tell them, you two don't like each other, I don't care. When we're on the pitch together, we play together to win. Because that's the effect a leader has. I don't see Rooney having any kind of... Bar his abilities on the pitch, I don't see many people respecting him as a man.
I disagree with that. I saw Wilshere's interview the other day. And he basically said, you know, Rooney's better than me in my own position. I think Rooney is one of the few players that we've got that people actually look up to in the England squad. Maybe not
on the pitch.
Even on the pitch. But you've got to remember, this is a very average England team. You think Henderson doesn't look up to Rooney? You think, you know what I mean? Like, it's not as if, you know, going back, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, then, you know, maybe Lampard or Gerrard would respect Rooney, but maybe not look up to him. But I think people will look at Rooney as, you know, one of the few senior pros. Don't get me wrong, I agree, Joe Hart is another one.
A lot of that's to do with age, in that half of them are young enough to watch Rooney's debut. Yeah. So therefore, they're not looking up to him in the way that you're necessarily looking up to someone who's better than you. It's just habit. In the same way you talk to an auntie or uncle who's older than you.
You know what? I don't disagree with that at all. But I do feel we have a lack. I'm not saying, you know, even in terms of being a captain, you know, Rooney's not a Tony Adams or a John Terry by any stretch of the imagination. We just don't have anyone else. Mm. If he's not there, Gary Cahill is the next in line for captaincy. And that, for me, that, and I'm a Chelsea man, for me that's terrible. So I just think we need kind of people with a presence, you know, in on the pitch. And as long as Rooney, for me, is performing as well as people in his position, the other things that he offers make him worth the first team. Now, if we had another central midfielder who's banging on the door to take him out, then I'm willing to take him out. So I just don't think we do.
Do we think that's why Roy didn't take Drinkwater?
Well, just before we get onto that, actually, but I want to actually just on the final point on Rooney, what I found quite interesting yesterday was that there was a big debate pre-Euros about Wayne Rooney, whether he should go, whether he shouldn't go. Roy Hodgson made it very, very clear, if he's fit, he's going. He's my captain, he's my leader, he's going. I'm most likely to play. But then in yesterday's game, he rested him. I just thought that the whole reason people keep telling me that Rooney is going is because mainly his experience and his leadership. But in a game that you need to win, surely Roy Hodgson would have played Rooney, despite the people saying he's not been great, play Rooney in that game, because that's the game you need your so-called most experienced leader on the pitch. And another reason why I wouldn't have taken Wayne Rooney is because he's not a good sub. He's not a very good sub. I wouldn't have played him if I was a manager at full stop. But when he came on the pitch yesterday, what did he do? Yeah. As bad as Jack Wilshere was, I thought, after the first 15 minutes, Jack Wilshere was quite poor. Was Rooney any better? Off the bench, Rooney's not quick. He's not a threat in the air. He's not got a trick on him.
My biggest issue...
I just don't see as a sub what he had. So you might as well play him from the start.
You pretty much, Man United fans and a lot of people in the media, their first reason of why you're playing Rooney in midfield is his range of passing. I've heard so many people say that.
I'm looking around.
Just because you can fling a ball across the side of the pitch doesn't mean your passing is good. Because if it doesn't equate to nothing, then it's a wasted pass.
Rooney can pick a pass.
He
It'll
can,
just be like one out of four.
Right, exactly. We ain't got time for one out of four. This is a knockout competition.
It's not a good ratio at all. It's not 25% of the passes that you're apparently very good at, only you make it as their man. That's not a very good ratio.
I could hit one in four.
It's not a good ratio. But then, what I mean, even, you know, and you know, the Man United fans on this podcast have been very critical of him, but he popped up with some key assists at crucial points towards the end of last season for Man United.
Yeah, but that's only because he could keep up with play. Let's keep it real. That's because he saw players.
Like, you know what?
I wasn't even thinking of the Norwich one, but
he could keep up with play.
Honestly, I just don't see that there's anyone who really offers more. That's what I'd say.
And to moving away from Rooney now, more to the team, another thing that I found quite interesting yesterday as well is that people keep going on about how a lot of the weaker teams are defending quite deep. Yeah. They're just banking up, trying to get a draw. We've seen that through many, many games. And I was thinking, for all the talk about, the substitutions of Rooney and Sturridge and all that, the person that should have really come off surely was Eric Dier. Because if you're playing a team that's got two banks of four and showing no attacking intent, surely you leave Jack Wilshere on, bring on Wayne Rooney for Eric Dier, because they're not going to really, really hurt you, are they? They've made their stall quite clear that we're going to bank in and try and get a point here. Does anyone else find it weird that Eric Dier wasn't substituted yesterday?
I do, personally. And I think...
He's been good, but he wasn't needed.
I think sometimes there is, and I think maybe, you know, my team are a part of the cause of it. I think there's an over-reliance on the defensive midfielder. Because I remember back in the night, when I was growing up, you might have brought the DM in the tough European away game.
Or local derbies.
Now everyone brings them in for every single game.
Sometimes two. No teams named.
Sometimes we'll be losing a game or drawing a game and actually bring a DM on at half time.
No more shots.
But yeah, so it's just kind of like, yeah, what is Dyer's role in attack versus defence?
I definitely think with England, as with, I think we saw a lot of teams in the Premier League last season, especially the teams that had high changes. So not people like Leicester, who didn't really use that many players. But you look at England and you don't really think that everyone knows what their job is. Mm. I think if everyone knows their job, like Wales, people going on about Wales, it's simple. There's no I in team. Teamwork makes the dream work. I know it's a cliche, but it's true, because every single player on that team knows their job. Whether Gareth Bale's playing up front by himself or like yesterday, everyone knows exactly what they're doing. They know if the ball's in that part of the pitch, that's mine to defend. I feel like with England, no one really, they think they know their job, but then they're a little bit worried that that's not their job. And if they do it, they'll do it wrong. So they leave it for someone else to do. Mm. And that's how you have like Joe Hart running out and banging into defenders, because obviously someone's not listening as to what their role is.
And is it quite concerning that is anyone else quite concerned about England's inability to open up teams? I've just watched a Germany game there, and they only won 1-0, but despite Northern Ireland banking in two banks of four, Germany had a strategy to try and make the pitch big. Mm. Move the ball quickly, and it created chances. Okay, England don't have an Ozil, don't have a Cruz, but is it quite concerning that England haven't quite worked out
how to create chances and break down
two banks of four?
People are saying, oh yeah, well, they're not losing, they look strong enough to cope with the better teams. Doesn't matter if you can cope with them. If you can't break them down, you're going to be in the same situation where you go to penalties and lose again. It's all well and good being able to defend against these so-called better teams and be strong and robust or whatever word they're using this week. But if you can't score, if you're not looking at a game and thinking, yeah, we had the most possession, but did we really have the best chances? It's not like you're watching Germany and you're thinking, boy, they could have scored 10 goals. You're not watching England and feeling the same way.
Do you think that it's a problem? I mean, the counter argument I've heard from a lot of people is that, but when they play against the better teams, they won't bank up. They'll come out and they'll put it on England, which allows England to then play better. Do you buy that argument? Or France, for example, ain't going to bank up with two banks of four, are they?
Yeah, but Italy's still going to defend like those other teams.
And France have been quite robust as well in their defence as well. No, I don't, because I haven't seen any evidence to suggest. Everyone, you know, Cahill's come out today and said, you know, we're going to give someone a battering. I mean,
I'm going to win the lottery this week.
You know, I haven't seen any. I mean, don't get me wrong, that, you know, they've kept the ball, they've moved it around nicely, they've played a good attacking. I can't even say good. They've played well. Attack versus defense. They've been able to retain possession well enough, but I can't see a fluidity. I can't see an invention, a creativity. And the important thing is, I can't see the plan B. And they've tried to go with the plan B with a two up front, and it just doesn't look good. We got a bit lucky versus Wales, to be fair. I think Wales defended well for the majority of the game, and a little ricochet in the box and Sturridge, you know, does what he does best. But overall, I wouldn't have called that, take away the euphoria. That was a good performance.
We are pretty much playing like the Theo Walcott of international football.
It's brainless.
Lots of pretty build up, but no end product.
Yeah.
Raheem Sterling, sympathy?
Sorry.
Wow, that laughs. That laugh just answered the question.
Sympathy for what?
Well, people know my views on Raheem Sterling, so I won't go into those now. But he probably won't kick another ball this tournament. He definitely ain't going to start another game this tournament. And in a game when England didn't score yesterday against Slovakia, there was no difference. So for all the heat that he's been getting, Sturridge played in the same position. England couldn't even score.
Well, Sturridge, you can't compare Sturridge and Sterling and what they're going to do in those same positions.
No, but the logic was Sturridge scored the winner, the hype, blah, blah, blah. Sterling's been poor.
I don't have sympathy for him because I feel he was lucky to go anyway. I think he definitely was lucky to be the one of two between him and Andros, because for all Andros's time at Spurs where he maybe wasn't playing, he's definitely one of them players. When he comes off the pitch, you never say he didn't do his best, you know. And I think sometimes there's a lot to be said for someone who maybe isn't the best player or the most creative player, but always gives that 100% on the pitch. And that's something like Eric, as we're seeing with Eric Dyer, not the most showy player. yeah, he scored the goal and we were like, wow, who knew he could hit a ball on target? But at the end of the day, he gives everything. And sometimes you need those kind of invisible players to make the team run properly.
Okay. Gabriel, Harry Kane, I think it was... I understand why he was dropped. Two games, he's not been particularly great. But do you think that it was potentially a mistake dropping him in that? I think if England go deep into this competition, they're going to need Harry Kane. And I think that maybe playing him against Slovakia yesterday and trying to get him out of this rut and trying to get that goal for him long-term may prove beneficial for England. Or do you just feel that in a pretty much must-win game yesterday, it wasn't a must-win in the end, but again, they kind of needed to win to top the group. Yeah. No risks. Put in Vardy. He's the hot guy. It was a gamble worth taking.
It's difficult. I mean, Harry Kane hasn't played well. Let's not pull any punches about that. And there's also been a lot of talk about his fatigue and whether he's tired. So a part of him being pulled out may have been around that. It's difficult to judge a striker who comes on for 10 minutes and gets a goal versus a striker who's been running for the whole game, because they might have tired out the defenders. It might have been their movement, their vision, and also bringing on extra strikers to help takes the focus off Harry Kane. So I didn't think Vardy or Sturridge particularly came in because they were hot. I think it was more that Kane hadn't performed. I do think we'll need Kane. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that he was dropped. I mean, he'll probably look and say, well, they've dropped Captain Rooney. They've dropped the right back Walker, who has been one of the better players as well. So I don't think he will look at it as being dropped or look at it as being,
I don't think he'll be vexed about it, but I just think that in terms of for England, you want your biggest goal threat.
I think we've seen with Harry Kane from last season, he does drop off towards the end of the season. It's the same reason why he didn't go away with the under-21s, because he wanted to be fresh. It was the under-21s, wasn't it? He didn't go away with...
I think he did go.
Did he go away?
And he was really poor.
Yeah.
I think he didn't go.
Yeah, I think he did. I remember, like, the end of the season again, he struggled. Maybe he's one of the few players that isn't going to, under Mr. Pochettino, have that kind of energy that we're seeing in the summer from others. Mm. He is, as they say, an old-school striker, blah, 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 blah. Maybe he needs a rest.
Yeah, but remember, he is Tottenham as well, so when it gets to the key points and
in the season of the year...
I didn't say that.
It's going to bottle it.
All right, let's move on. Wow.
Tottenham fans are going to be bottling you.
They're going to get the courage to do it.
Pick up the bone, drop it.
Let's move on from England now. Let's widen it out a little bit. France, Natasha, why haven't they clicked yet? And is it a concern?
I don't think it's a concern until the first knockout game. I think... because being the home team, you saw in that first game, the fans are just waiting to get on their back. You know, every minute that goes without them scoring or without Pogba looking superb, you could feel the tension. And I think some teams thrive off that and others don't. I feel like they're now getting to the point, you know, they lost Varane, and I think that was probably a really big loss for them, you know. Koscielny has his moments. He can be great, but he can also be very nerve-wracking. And I think losing Varane scared them a bit. So when they were starting the competition, they were kind of playing on the back foot to protect that defence. But yeah, I still see them being in the final four. I don't think it's a real concern, because they will score goals. And when it comes down to it, they have got the crowd on their side.
Okay. Dimitri Payet has probably been the player of the tournament, arguably, so far. There's one standout player. After the first two games, everybody was like, oh, West Ham, he'll go. Someone will take him. Then I was a bit like, well, I don't think they will lose him, simply because I think he'll only leave for a team that A, can offer Champions League football, and B, he's guaranteed to play in that 11. And there's only probably PSG that tick both of those boxes. Do you know what I mean? So, but now, another game on, and I've seen how well he's doing. Now I'm a bit like, yeah, somebody might just throw 45 million at him and just think, you know what, we'll take you, even at 29. Do you think he'll be at West Ham next year if he continues with this form?
I think they will. I think he just signed a new contract recently. Now, I know contracts, but I don't think there is the team out there who'd be willing to pay the money and to kind of put him in the team and build a team around him. I don't think there is there are the options out there. I don't think there's the team that's that desperate that's going to want to go and pay the big money for the player who's just signed a new contract, who maybe has a secret buyout clause that we don't know about that's probably astronomical. I don't think... You said PSG was the option. He came over from France. Why didn't PSG pick him up when he was leaving, you know? So I don't really see anyone who would come in for him. I mean, I would take him at Chelsea. I think most teams would, but I don't think there's anyone who's going to push the boat out. Kind of like what we talked about but off air, like with Lukaku and stuff, you know. I think the price might put other teams off.
Tasha, do you think he'll be there next year?
Yeah, I do. I think probably the key point is West Ham don't need to sell him. Mm. You know, we're going to talk about pundits later, but if anyone isn't in love with Slaven Bilic by now, then I don't know what they've been watching, because he just seems... like a great manager and a great pundit. And I think, as he said to Petit, we're loaning him to you for the summer. He is going to sell his shirt to make sure Payet stays in that team. West Ham, it's not like when they had your Frank Lampards and your Joe Coles and your Rios. They're not that team anymore. They're not fighting relegation. They can say to him, look, we are going to push further this season than we did the last. We're going to keep the people we have, bring in some new people. Do you want to be a hero at West Ham? In, you know, the big fish in the small pond, or do you want to go to a huge pond and be the little fish?
Okay. G, Pogba, yeah. What is he?
It's, you know what? It's a strange one. I can't really put my finger on it, because I guess some people will say he kind of he's a box-to-box midfielder, but then his goal return is not that great. He always seems to take really nice shots, and they're pretty close, like just whistle past the bar, but I never see them go in.
You know? A little bit like Ozil in that sense.
Yeah. But he's obviously got immense quality, and I think I've seen a bit more of it in the French team in terms of being the driving force, in terms of moving them forward. I think it's exactly what we need at Chelsea, and I'm one of those fans who watches these tournaments mainly to see
who we can get
or who we're linked to,
and
who we're performing with, and like, he would be my number one target if I could, but I couldn't pigeonhole him into a particular position at the moment. I just think he's a good all-round midfielder, and not enough of him in the game.
For all the talk, Natasha, people talking about if he leaves Juventus, it would be a world record transfer fee. I'm hearing about 100 million is what it'll take to get him to leave Juventus. I've always thought, but as G says, he's got clear qualities. I've never been completely convinced about his consistency to deliver and show those qualities. It's almost a little bit like Yaya Toure, reminds me. He's got all the qualities to be a top midfielder, but he just seems to have those days where he just seems to think, yeah, today I don't really feel like it. And then another day where he'll win the game and score two worldies. Do you think the player justifies the hype?
I think because... he has, well, we have to hope he does, otherwise we're all going to be proved wrong again. I think sometimes we get spoiled and we see players like Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo who were superb at such a young age. So we see players like him and we think, really, we're saying, why aren't you as good as them? But really, he's still better than the rest who were 5-6 years older than him. I think it's very much about, he's going to be one of those players for me. It's going to be about the player, what he decides to do, whether he makes the right choice by staying at Juventus or going to another club. I think he has to really consider what he wants, where he sees his career going. I think sometimes players are flattered by money and prestige and stuff. You want to hope he's got a good family around him, because he probably will be the best player in the world at some point. I definitely think we're getting to the point now, like with Messi and Ronaldo getting, well, Ronaldo being rubbish in the Euros, where midfielders are going to be the next kind of group of players, where all the top players are going to be midfielders. We never really pay attention to defenders anyway, but I do think it's becoming more about the midfield men in the team than just the strikers.
He doesn't really need to leave Juventus as well, because I mean, barring a City or a Chelsea even, or a Madrid offering to double his wages, the team's pretty much built around Pogba, it seems, at Juventus. They seem to love him at Juventus. He's winning trophies at Juventus. He doesn't really need to leave. They're not a small club. Do you know what I mean?
But we all know that it's one of those sort of clubs that if things start going wrong, they will turn very quickly. it's all well and good, everyone. It's like being clapped out the front door or being booed out the back, isn't it? Mm. It's about if you want to leave and you want to move on, it's about picking the right time to leave or move on.
And just finally on France, is it just me or has Evra been the worst player of this tournament so far?
Oh man!
It might just be me.
I feel sad for him. I feel sad for him.
Not one bad game and one okay. Both games he's been a 4 out of 10. That's being kind.
You feel like he needs to be put out of his misery.
Just come on.
I don't want to call him the worst because I actually like him as a player. And you know what? There's been some pretty bad performances as well. But it's hard to think of someone off the top of my head.
One player, especially a top nation, that in two games has been as poor as he has in two games.
I can't give it an answer. Maybe I'll have to accept what you said. Right.
Let's move on now a little bit to there was obviously some violence and some scuffles and some casualties through some of the violence and hooliganism that we saw in the first 10 days, 2 weeks of the tournament so far. Gabriel, do you think football federations can be held accountable for the behaviour of their footballing of the footballing nations?
It's difficult. I think it's got to be a combination of a lot of things. I think first thing it's got to be the culture within the within the country itself. You know, not every nation feels the need to come over and put their chest out, or even in some cases actually go and look and arrange and organise fights. That's not something that exists in every culture. So yes, I think as a country, you have to take responsibility. The football federations do need to take some responsibility. They need to identify the people, you know, the persistent offenders.
They always say that. We're looking at the video cameras. We're going to try and find out who they are.
They do arrest a lot of people, and not just
not
like...
enough, clearly.
Well, that's like saying we don't have all the legal guns in the world. We'll probably never get everything. But the fact that they're not just doing it a week before the Euros, they were arresting people like months before the Euros. Yeah. So those people can't travel nowhere.
And it's funny, I actually saw a stat that said only 5% of the people that have actually been arrested in France have been English. Okay. Out of all of the arrests. So maybe we're not as bad as things are made out.
Our fans more.
Yeah. Or we just are better at running away, or they can't arrest us all. But I think you also have to look at the country where the event's being held. Now I do feel a bit sorry for France in that it's very accessible, and you know, I guess you know we've got the vote on Thursday. You know, their borders have been criticised a few times in terms of people being able to get in. You know. Get on the boat. just seem to
be. Any man could rock up to France and get in.
Because we didn't have these problems in Brazil, did we? No. So I think France might need to look. I mean, I guess that's a deeper political problem, you know.
But it links into the tournament. Yeah, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. So what can be done, Natasha, in terms of, because we can't just every tournament now, you know, just accept that there's always going to be, you know, people are dying and people are getting seriously injured. And I'm thinking something hard needs to be done. And I'm just wondering, my question was, can the footballing federations, i.e. the FA, the Russian FA, the Irish FA, can they be held accountable in some way for the actions of their fans?
I think they have to take a proportion of the blame. As we said, you know, if these people are repeat offenders and it's the same people going to the Euros that we see causing trouble at a domestic football game, then we need to identify those people and, you know, take their passports. If you have to lock them up because they're not going to stay in the country, then that's what you have to do. I also think, much like the FA did, and I have to give them their dues, they straight away came out and condemned the fans that were causing problems. Mm. They weren't mincing about it. They weren't saying, oh, well, it's not our fans. They said, if you're coming out here to cause problems, we will not help you. We're not here to support you. Come out here, support the team, have some food, have something to drink and enjoy yourself. But then there is this, because we have a problem where UEFA and FIFA and a lot of the countries don't like each other or don't listen to each other, there's not one group all kind of punishment that you could do, because if everyone got on, it would be like being extradited. You know, if your fans are caught doing this in France, when we ship them back to you, they should go on trial or they should serve out their sentence here. But because we have all this political I don't even know the right word to put it.
Discourse and friction.
Yeah, discourse and friction. It's very hard that you're going to get all those numbers of countries to agree to something. I think we can only do what we can do. And I think as fans, we have a responsibility. I saw a picture today, which isn't one of the worst things I've seen, but someone's granddad, I presume, naked in a public area in the middle of the day. He was an English fan because of his kit that he had on. But you know what? We as fans have got to say to our fellow fans, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, not to be rude or nothing, if you've had a bit to drink, if I'm walking home and I've been drinking, I'm not going to walk down the alleyway with no lights. You know, I'm going to walk down the main road or I'm going to get in a taxi. We have to also, I'm not saying that people are to blame for what's happening, but you also have to have a risk assessment in your head that says, hold on a minute, I don't speak the language, I'm pissed, maybe I should go home. Maybe I shouldn't be mouthing off to a bunch of people I don't know in a random bar. You have to have common sense.
And just have a respect for people's country, man. People come to your country, smash out your bars. Well, yeah. And rude.
There were fans helping clean up as well, we should say
there
that.
There were. Do you feel that France, and it might tie into Gabriel's earlier point, do you think France was really prepared and ready for this tournament? And I ask that because when you get in 15 flares getting snuck in, well, 15 that we saw from the pitch in the Croatia,
given what's happened in the past year.
Exactly. That's the 15 we saw. Flares, I've seen flares. They're not small. They are not small. How the hell do you get flares into a ground? Either the security is incompetent or they knew it was going on and allowed it. Either way, do you feel France has really been prepared and ready for the fan element of this tournament?
Well, I've spoke to people who have been out there and people who haven't, and the general consensus is that UEFA have the control of the security at the stadiums. So if that is correct, then UEFA really need to sit down and give themselves a kick up the behind. Because given what's gone on in France, even I'm watching games and I hear things go off and I jump. Mm. And, you know, I've always been one of them people, I don't see why you're taking flares to football. I don't understand it. It's not big. It's not clever. Especially when you go to a stadium like Fulham that's made out of wood anyway. You know, I ain't about to get burnt down. But I do think UEFA, the French authorities and the other countries should have all been sitting down together and talking about it and making sure there's a clear plan. It shouldn't be just one person's fault, because then you just, you know, it's better to have 10 minds come together and come to a solution than have one.
Gabriel, just do you think that maybe they were so they being France were so concerned and so on the ball in terms of a possible terror attack that they maybe slightly took their eye off the ball in terms of the hooligan element of a football tournament?
Yeah, but it goes back to what I said before, where I feel a bit sorry for them, because they politically, you know, we know they have the issues with the civil liberties, so they can't do the type of searches that we might be able to do in the UK or different parts. It's very difficult for them. So yeah, they probably did have just too many balls to juggle. And I guess after the attack, you know, we had a discussion about it, whether it was still the appropriate place, whether it was still the right place to go for the tournament, whether we as football fans would go, and we all agreed we would go. I just think maybe as football fans, knowing that and knowing that there's that threat, you know, we should again go back to what Natasha said about taking responsibility. You know, be a bit more responsible, knowing that these people are out here actually trying to save your life from actually from a terrorist attack, you know. But but you say they're keeping their eye on the ball in relation to that. It's a bit scary about getting the flares in. How much are they actually watching it if they can do that?
Okay. Well, a friend of mine went to France. On the way there, they took some fluffy handcuffs and got into the country fine. On the way back, they were stopped. They were taken off them. So this is obviously a wider issue when people are travelling, what you can and can't bring. Mm. Otherwise, why would you be selling flares? The whole point is no one is going to walk up and say, I'm a terrorist. That's not how terrorists work. So when people say they're concentrating on the terrorist issue, anyone acting suspiciously or carrying suspicious material is classed, you know, in the eyes of the law as a terrorist suspect. So therefore, they can't be doing their jobs properly if all these things are still getting in the stadium. Because how do they know what's hidden inside a flare or down someone's trousers? If you're not picking up a flare, how do I know you're not picking up something that could be potentially more dangerous for all of us?
Okay, just another couple of quick ones on this one. Russia, they are out. do you think that the trouble now will stop in terms of that firm will now just move on or even be forced to move on? All the fans will be told, Russia, you're out, go home.
Well, quite a few of those were kind of arrested and deported, but it wouldn't surprise me if they rocked up at the next big England game. You know, so no, I wouldn't rule out more trouble. Unless, don't get me wrong, it seems as if Russia have been their kind of protagonist in this, but let's not take things away from myself. Like, I still think there is the potential of one bad game or something going wrong, and our fans might kick off as well. So, yeah, I don't think it's the last. It seems to have subsided a bit, but I don't think it's necessarily the last of the trouble.
And just finally, Russia have the next World Cup. Any concerns about how, forget UEFA, the Russian authorities themselves are dealing with their own troubles and their own fans? I mean, would you be going to Russia if I gave you two tickets in 2 years to the World Cup?
Oh, this is a question that keeps coming up a lot. I'm a black female, so
yeah, maybe.
So not. You know, I'm. Do you know? I'll be honest. Watching the Euros with my mum and the trouble that was going on with the English fans and the Russian fans the first couple of days, and I looked at her reaction, and I think I honestly would have to question if I can put her through that, knowing that I'm going to a country that has a history of racism and prolonged racist abuse to anyone that is not of their nationality, let alone, not only that, I'm English and black and female. So we know these issues are there. Can I put my life in the hands of people that have publicly said they don't treat people like me with any respect? And that's not to mention their issues with gay people and all the other people they dislike. I think it's a very, very scary... It's a scary option. I don't know if I'd go. If I was working, it would be different because I'd be getting paid, but I'd still have to really consider it because I have to think that I'm not saying it's easier for a guy, but if a guy wants to fight another guy, it's more even-handed. Mm. I'm 5'1". Mm. Like, I've got a big mouth, but really and truly, that ain't going to save me if someone wants to come at me with a chair. Mm. And I do have to think, in a country like that, I don't know that I'd feel safe.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I've only been to Moscow once. It was quite a bad day for me. It was the Champions League final. I have to say, despite all of those problems, and I think they do exist, and I did feel an atmosphere when I got there. I didn't know necessarily it was to do with my race, but I think it was an atmosphere of, we've got 40,000 English people coming here, so you guys, we're not going to entertain you at all. So you got to passport control, everyone was solemn. You got out on the street, there was police everywhere. But the one thing I would say is that there was no trouble from it, you know? It did ruin the atmosphere, it did ruin the vibe a bit, because you'd expect two English teams in another city, you'd expect there to be a whole lot of singing, a party. There was nothing. All right, there was a bit of rain on the day as well, which always dampens it. But whenever there just seemed to be like crowds kind of coming together, even if they were just like friendly, you'd see a line of policemen.
I think the difference
jackets.
Is, though, that's one game. That's one game. We can contain everyone. They're all going to the same place. That's a lot easier to control. As we've seen in France, some of these cities where stadiums are tiny. So fans are being advised to stay elsewhere and travel up on the day. I've had friends that were like on packed trains and, you know, or delays and not able to get water because shops were closed and all kinds of things like that. How many? I don't know how many fans go to the Euros, to the World Cup, but it's quite a few.
Yeah.
Can they control the fans that are there to have a good time and control the dangerous element that is coming from abroad as well as coming from their own country?
Yeah. See, I think
without our help.
Personally, I think from what I saw, I think if they care enough about you, they probably can. But when it goes back to Natasha's point, is how much do they care
when the head of their FA or their supporters federation is saying, encouraging their fans to go and fight.
I'm not really feeling
like I can trust it.
It's not a good look, and it's a big country as well, so the games will be spread out across a big country. So
sparse land as well. There's a lot of places to hide around there.
Or go missing.
Well, I never said that.
All right, let's go back to the football now, guys. So who's impressed? Who's impressed for you guys? Player or team so far?
Not many, to be fair, but I'm going to step my head out and probably go with Wales. You know, I like a really well organized team where people know their roles, and I think again Bale has kind of really showed up and shined, not just shined as an individual like Ronaldo tries to do, like,
as a figure as well,
as a team figure, player.
A figure and a team player. Yes, he's tried to include everyone. He's tried to, you know, and I think he's really, really embarrassing gigs. I know it's probably quite
completely right. Agree.
But he actually really shows that he cared about his country, where Giggs couldn't give a toss. And there were certain points where the team that Giggs was in
was better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
minus, you know, Robbie Savage.
Yeah.
In fact, most of Giggs' teams were better because they had Hughes, Saunders, Hughes, I think Bellamy. Rush at the start, Bellamy.
Yeah.
And that's yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, but he's came on there. He's made himself one of the lads of the team, and he's really showed a lot of pride and passion in actually playing for his country, which is kind of lost on kind of the elite players at the moment, especially when they're at the height of their career. He's gone to Real Madrid. He's just won the Champions League. He could have easily have taken this as a little bit of a holiday and a PR tour.
He could have had a muscle strain, yeah. You know. We like you say with Giggs, he didn't really care. I think I have to agree, Wales I love the whole kind of, I'm very much team effort people. I'm not into this one man team thing, and I've been saying for ages that Wales are not, but I think we have to give a lot of credit to Chris Coleman.
That was going to be my next bit, yeah. But I'll let you go on.
Because I mean, Gary Speed, legend in the game as a player and a manager, and obviously his tragic death, I think for their nation, can't imagine what they went through. And everyone talks about what he started, but for Chris Coleman to come in at that awful time and to get those players' heads right, get them motivated, and to get them to carry on what Gary Speed had started, I think is immense.
Completely agree.
Because when you see the clips of the first game after he passed, and there's players in tears. You know, we've all experienced death in our life. It's not easy to get through, let alone in an environment like that where the public eyes are on you. I think Wales have just been a credit to their country.
I agree. I think on Coleman, I think it's really good that you mentioned that, because I agree, in that tough times when the nation mourned a guy that was clearly a hero to them.
Yeah.
And he was doing quite well. They were on the rise.
They were seeing this new Wales.
They were. And to come in, and he changed things as well, Coleman. So to be fair to him, he could have kept it. He could have just towed the party line, kept it as it was. Don't want to rock the boat and be seen as going against Gary Speed's work. He changed things. He changed the captain, because Ramsey was the captain when he came in, and he gave that to Ashley Williams. I think finishing top of the group was a real testament to the kind of work that he's put in, and how I agree how he's got the whole team, squad, and nation working together. And I thought that it was they deserved to finish top. Despite losing to England, they could have imploded after that. They could have really imploded.
I never felt that they would, though, because I just feel like if everyone's on the same page, you know, you can get, if one person's down, you've got another person say, come on, mate, let's go and play some PS3, do you know what I mean? And no, because they're friends, you can see that. Like, you see Aaron Ramsey, you know, his best man and his best mates in the team. They share a room together. Ledley and Hennessy share a room together. That's real friendship. Something that we tend to see less in the men's teams, more in the women's teams internationally. And I think when you look at England, maybe they could take something from that real togetherness.
Yeah.
Because Wales, to me, look like 23 people who actually look like they like each other rather than 23 people that tolerate each other.
Any players that you've, maybe beyond the top teams, is any player you've looked at and thought, oh,
God,
right.
I can't believe I'm saying this. Kyle Walker.
Really? Why?
Because I've never been a fan. I always felt like he was not fast enough to be a winger, but maybe not good enough to be a defender. But I have to say, out of the other than Dyer, who is no surprise, I think if anyone's watched him for the past few years, he's no surprise. But I do think Kyle Walker's really stepped up his game. I think he's gone about things quietly, and sometimes that's the best way to do things. Like, just go about your work quietly and don't draw too much attention. Defend when you need to and go forward when you need to.
I don't know. Everyone's picking up Kyle Walker. He's had no defending to do. And I think he's the best player. I agree.
Isn't that the easiest time to make a mistake? Like, when we say keepers, when they've had nothing to save, the easiest time to make a mistake is when you've had no work to do. It's about keeping your concentration levels right.
He's got one thing he's good at, and that's running forward with a ball. His delivery. If you look at his deliveries aren't great. He's getting lots of deliveries in, but his deliveries aren't great. I think he's the best player in a average team.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think everyone's sort of
but
like
it's
Carl
better
Walker.
To be the best player in an average team than the worst player in an average team.
Yeah, yeah. I'm dampening down your praise of him, which I shouldn't do. But
as a gooner,
I just think he's crap. I just think he's playing well, but I still think he's crap.
Although Henderson was good last night.
Oh, he was rubbish. Really?
Considering he hasn't played for three months. To be fair, England have been
pretty doody. Anybody stood out for you in this tournament?
Well,
so far?
You've really talked about Payet and Pogba. I think they've had good tournaments as well. We talked about Bell.
Ramsey's had a good tournament.
Ramsey's had a decent tournament as well.
They're all right.
The tournament has really, really let me down. And I think you can more talk about the players who've let you down than the players who have actually showed up for me in this tournament. So I see the tournament in two stages. Mm. Once we get past the next knockout stage, I think the best players hopefully should step up. And you know what, in terms of people who have really let me down as well, I was so disappointed with the way Ronaldo acted about Iceland. Because at the end of the day, like, Iceland are, I think they're the smallest nation ever compete in the tournament. They got a draw. Of course they're going to be celebrating. He wouldn't swap shirts. He looked
Last
down.
Wasn't it?
It was
Ronaldo.
Anyone who knows Ronaldo. Me knows I've never had time for Ronaldo as a person. He's the sort of man, I remember the Champions League final, people were saying, do you think Ronaldo would rather they lost or that Bale scored the winner? That's the sort of player he is. He doesn't.
Also, if you look at him as well, any time at Madrid or Portugal, another player scores,
yeah,
he almost frowns.
Yeah,
he punched the ground when Bale scored. He doesn't like another people score.
Yeah,
he doesn't like it. I've watched him like frown and almost okay, I'll come and jump on you as a celebration because I
kind
of have to. But he doesn't want to.
He can cuss Iceland all he wants. If he was that good a player, he would have found a way to win the game against them. So therefore, you're vexed about your own. Well, slacking abilities because you're not as fast as you used to be. Your injuries are taking their toll. You're more annoyed at yourself, but have a bit of class.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and
that's why people like Messi.
Yeah, he did. I like the right back. The Portuguese right back. He's really good. There's a midfielder for Switzerland again. Forgotten his name, who looks good. Not Ajax, although I think he's been pretty decent as well. Northern Ireland. Been impressed by Northern Ireland. They could go through as the best second best third place team.
But the thing is, that's for me, and it goes back to the format of the tournament. That's nothing to be impressed about.
Come on, it's Northern Ireland. They've got four Premier League players.
I think their fans don't really care. I think as long as they come here and do their best and give their all, they're just happy to be
those
there.
Fans were raving against Germany earlier on.
You know what? You know,
the Germans were. I was surprised. The Germans love their Europop. Where was their raving?
Yeah, I'm doing a disservice because I know Iceland, Hungary, and all those, you know, for their fans, this is amazing. But I just can't be inspired by that. I'd rather you qualified in a normal state. You know,
they did come on top, to be fair.
They came top. Hungary came top, yeah.
No, I think Ireland as well came top.
Iceland came top, yeah, yeah.
Northern Ireland came top. So even if the format had no change.
Didn't they widen out the group stages? And then
you can only beat what's in front of you.
They finished top still. Even if it was an easier group, they finished top.
How many teams in this tournament, does the commentator start the game by saying, this is their first time in it for 30 years. This is their first goal in the tournament for 10 years. This is their first, you know what I mean? It just...
To be fair,
it's diluted the quality.
If it's Jonathan Pearce, that's his opening gambit with anyone. He literally tells you when he's giving you the starting lineup, this player scored so many goals, this player, it's not new.
Just a couple of players I want to mention as well. Iniesta, best midfielder in the world, even at 39, whatever he is.
What now?
Class is permanent, form is temporary.
I still think there's not a better midfielder that I would take over him, even at his age. Anybody better you've seen in midfield this tournament so far?
When you said best midfielder in the world, I thought, well, hold on. But then when you think about based on performances, it's difficult. You might argue Pogba.
I'd still take Iniesta, but not now.
He's not better. I mean, but based on his performances in the tournament, you might argue Pogba. You might even argue Payet.
Yeah, I'd still take Iniesta. Perisic at Croatia. Is it Croatia? Yeah, the right midfielder. You guys seen him?
Yes.
I think Croatia might have some players come into the Premier League soon.
They're a bit steely.
They may be our next area to go and pillage after South America. player-wise, not gold or sugar.
punditry watch. Let's do a punditry watch, guys. Who's been doing well for you in, over the course of the coverage of the Euro so far? Across ITV and, well, all formats, radio, TV. Who have you been impressed by so far?
It's another thing that I've been uninspired by. There isn't... I think Natasha talked about Slaven Bilic, who I liked. But apart from that, there hasn't really been anyone that stood out to me. It's more... Who have I been able to bear? You know, I think I find Keown boring. Yeah, it's just dull to listen to, and he talks about trends which are not there. So he'll say, "Oh, this is happening," but it's just what's happened right now. Everybody can see it, but it's not actually a trend. It isn't actually insightful. So no, I haven't been impressed with Keown. I think the England and Wales game got a bit. Almost embarrassing. Yes, they didn't.
Oh my God!
They didn't say we. They almost didn't say we, but they said everything else. But you know what I mean? It was just poor. I can't think of one pundit, maybe apart from Bilic, that I'd say is really kind of stood out to
me. Some good ones. I think Vianney's been good. I think Ian Wright's been good.
So first thing we have to.
Ian Wright.
I think he's been good. I think ITV is his format.
I was about to say. Firstly, ITV have weed all over the BBC. I'll tell you why. Because the BBC have Rio, for a start, and he's rubbish. I'm sorry.
That's harsh.
I do like
Rio. Rio finds a way to always bring the conversation back to him. If you're talking about how to defend, it will be when I defended against, when I played with.
But isn't he supposed to offer insight?
No,
right?
But that's not insight. That's recalling memories. There's a difference.
Well, I think if he ties in an example in the game to maybe what he would have done as a defender from a defensive point of view, is that not then fair?
What? That's single game? That's the only way you can analyse it.
I've not noticed that, to be fair. Okay, so maybe I'll look out for it now.
BBC have got Robbie Savage, so again, I can't.
As a mark off, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the whole him and Martin Keown, who I love, but the England Wales thing, it was embarrassing. It was basically two slightly tipsy guys in the pub trying to see who could piss further up a urinal. Excuse my language. That's what it was. And both of them were embarrassing themselves because they weren't looking at the game and saying that was right, that was wrong. They were saying...
It got a bit too patriotic on both their
halves. No, it just got silly. Okay. Not even patriotic. Like, that wasn't a foul. But yeah, it was. Just because it's against your team. I love Lee Dixon. I think... Why are you looking at me like that?
I think Lee Dixon is a solid pundit. He's not particularly exciting, but I think he's a solid... solid.
Do we want exciting? Was Jimmy Hill exciting?
I don't think it's the most important quality for a pundit, but I think if you can have a bit of charisma, yeah. Which is what I think Ian Wright does do, then it's, you know, it's television. I want to watch someone that's a little bit engaging, a little bit off the wall. Isn't that what we like about Bilic? On top of the insightfulness, he's a little bit off the wall.
No, I like him because he's really organised. He has notes. I have this thing about if you're covering a game, please do your research. It's another issue I have with the BBC.
I think they all have notes. He just happens to have his in his hand all the time. So we just see his piece of paper.
We know they have researchers, but his notes, what he says comes across like, I've done my research, not the researcher gave it to me. Yeah. So I don't know. Petit's not been bad.
I think Petit's been decent. He's been decent, yeah.
Who else has there been?
I think in the BBC now. He's been on the BBC.
Henri's been about on
Henri's
the
been decent. He's been solid.
He has. He's been better than Sky. He's getting better.
I think Henri's getting better. John Hartson's been poor. I think he's been a bit poor. Kilbane a bit bluer. And just finally on the punditry, I've noticed as well that there's a lot more, but there's more women across both the channels as well, across BBC and ITV. So for ITV, it's Jackie Oatley, who I think has done really, really well. Been impressed with her. For the BBC, they've had a few kind of regional.
They've had Ali Baba, who's been doing a lot of the little montages.
Yeah,
I think she's done a really, really great job. She's been like going behind the scenes at like Iceland and things like that.
I want to get both your views on this. What has slightly annoyed me a little bit is I've forgotten her name. The tennis player. What's her name?
Oh yeah,
Marion Bartoli.
Yeah,
she. Have you seen Marion Bartoli?
What was with that jacket?
Oh, the kind of the really colourful one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Do you feel? And I'll come to you first. This one, as a female that works in sports media, do you feel it's a little bit of a backward step getting someone like her to do that kind of a bit informal reporting gig? And I don't think she's doing a bad job. But the kind of excitement and the hype she brings, I think, is a little bit OTT. And at the cost of, there are other female reporters and journalists that could do that job. But because she's a tennis player with a little bit of a profile, she gets that gig.
I would.
What do you think? She's just doing a good job, and hey, she's doing a good job.
I have an issue with this generally, because I think a lot of pundits as well are given jobs that could go to people who have maybe been more trained in journalism, and they get to go jump 10 steps up the ladder rather than people like myself and others who have to crawl the 1, 2, 3 steps that we get. I feel like if they're going to use her, they should use her in the fan zone rather than interviewing people, discussing the football. She seems very enthusiastic. That's really nice. But in the kind of coverage we have over here, especially on ITV where you have ad breaks, enthusiasm isn't just the be all and end all. You may have 3-4 minutes with someone and she's there with Louis Saha, for example. I want her to ask him a real question. Get his opinion on how they've played, how they should line up. Not, oh, it's a great atmosphere here. Yeah, that's great. Go in the fan zone and do that. I can watch you on ITV too if I want to. But I do think it's a double-edged sword, because if I say I don't think she should get the job, people may think it's because I would prefer the job. No, I would just rather they gave it to someone who had a bit more experience within journalism in football, you know.
What have you made of her? Have you seen a lot of her?
No, I haven't seen too much, to be honest. I mean, I can't disagree with anything what you guys have said. I don't see much insight. I don't see really challenging questions. I don't see her getting the best out of her guests. I just see her being a bit excitable.
Yeah.
Okay. Which is not worth it. And before you move on as well, Glenn Hoddle calling for Andy Carroll last night. That what the shocking. Hell was that?
That was shocking.
I can't
that
believe
was really it. Bad. Yeah. And I'm a Hoddle fan. I think normally.
Really?
I just think others have caught him up. I think 2-3 years ago, Hoddle was really strong in his insight and his knowledge, especially technically, about football players. Yeah. I think he's been caught up. I think he's definitely been caught up now. But that comment yesterday, even I was a bit like, don't say that again.
And the thing is, he's got a reputation for being quite a forward-thinking football man. Yeah. And he just kind of relegated himself.
He let himself down there. I've got to say a big shout out to Leon Mann, who we both know, being Natasha.
Yes.
He's doing reporting for ITV out there. He's the fair skin guy that's been doing some stuff out there.
And he's been working hard in the gym. Have you seen those arms?
I haven't noticed that, but I just wanted to give him a quick shout out. As someone
thanks
that's
for having
no, he'll love that. He'll love that.
So big up to him. All right, final point, guys. I want to talk about something domestic, which happened a couple of weeks ago. Eva Caneiro, she settled out of court regarding her her allegations against Chelsea that she was dismissed dismissed wrongfully.
So constructive dismissal.
Sexual discrimination.
Sly sacking.
No, no.
They
what,
sacked me in a sly
what,
way.
What it means is what it means is that you that someone does something or makes the situation in your workplace so hostile or changes your workplace so
a sly sacking.
So no, that you're forced to resign, that you can't plausibly continue in your job.
Okay. Geez, Chelsea fan here. Do you feel that her settlement devalued her overall argument, which was that she felt that she was being treated differently, wrongly, and she wanted, she clearly had things to say.
Yeah.
Jose turns up, Chelsea turn up. There's was it 5 mil? I think there's been reported.
That's the rumor. Yeah,
the alleged amount.
For. And she goes quiet again and takes it and goes. Do you feel that though? I thought she conducted herself really well throughout the whole process in terms of keeping her counsel to a degree.
To a degree.
And wanted to reveal what was going on and say, get her point across. But the money just seems to have kind of almost shut her up.
Personally, and you know, people would disagree, I think it was always about the money for her. I think, you know, in terms of what happened on the touchline on that day, I think Jose, you know, his reaction was clearly over the top, and you know, possibly unjustified, depending on whose side you sit on. I don't see any evidence for constructive. Well, I think there's an argument for constructive dismissal, but I disagree with it on the basis that yes, whereas she wouldn't have been on the bench anymore, which is about kind of 2 hours of her work a week. Yeah, I think the main portion of a doctor's work is actually behind the scenes, treating the players. And actually, I think Chelsea were one of the first, well, one of the early teams to actually put a doctor on the bench. You know, effectively, someone coming off the bench to actually treat players is actually a physiotherapist role, technically.
You don't most of them are actually trained doctors, but work as physiotherapists.
Work as physiotherapists, yeah. So as a club doctor, you don't necessarily need to be on the bench to do your job. But there's an argument, because I guess she could see it as a demotion. She could see it as being undermined publicly. What I strongly disagree with is that it was on the basis of the fact that she was a female. And because I think, you know, like I said, Jose did treat her badly, but he's treated Anders Frisch badly. He's treated countless referees badly. He's treated his own players badly. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that's right or it's wrong, but I don't think it was about her gender. I don't think it was. And I think she was aware of that. Or maybe her legal team was aware of that.
And I
think she deliberately made it about her gender. She deliberately made it to say that she couldn't continue in her role so that she can get the maximum amount back from things. Now, people might say, well, what's 5 million to Chelsea? You know, they deserve that. Two fingers to Mourinho, whatever. But I think there is a serious underlying issue around kind of sexism in the workplace. And I think it trivializes those issues when you use those issues to your own ends to try to get the maximum money. I mean, you talked about her keeping her counsel and wanting to say what's going on. As a part of her case, she had to kind of highlight, I mean, she's always said, you know, a part of her case that Chelsea is her dream job, and she kind of feels like this incident has stolen her dream job away from her. But then, you know, to make a sexual discrimination case against and constructive dismissal against the club, she's then had to come back and go back through the archives and look at things that she said she wasn't happy with the club, not just what Jose did, so other things as well. And that's where I think she lacked a bit of class for me, because some of the things that she brought up, you kind of think, well, one, why don't you just discuss them at work? And two, they just seem quite petty anyway, like they didn't buy me a suit. And I know people were going to say, well, I've picked out the silliest one out of them, but there was only about four or five, and that was on the list.
Okay.
So, like I said, I think she is being held as kind of some kind of hero. I think Chelsea would have always, I think people will look at Chelsea and say, well, if it wasn't the case, you didn't, why did you settle? Chelsea would have always wanted to settle, because winning the court case would have still have been losing the war, in that sense that Eva could still go on GMTV, go on anywhere else, write a book, tell other things about what's happened, like when AVB got sacked, and really kind of spill the guts. So Chelsea always would have wanted a settlement, probably wanted a settlement even more than they wanted to win the case.
Okay.
So in that sense, but in the amount of money that she got, I think she's got a cheek asking for to take a 5 million. If I got 5 million out of that situation, especially if I'm claiming that I'm doing this for the women, half of that has got to go back into a charity or something that helps women, because you don't need 5 million and it's an unjust figure.
Tasha, do you feel that she should have stood her ground and not settled? And by doing so, she's almost undone a lot of the apparent good work she did on behalf of many women in sport.
Can I just say, I'm really proud of the growth I've made over the past few months that I didn't interrupt you at various points. I think Marv would have been really proud of me. I was good. If you heard the chewing, that was me not interrupting, just eating Chris. God, where do I start? If you think it was about the money, you are completely missing the point. I think what a lot of people don't realise is the situation that occurred with Dr. Eva is not a one-off. Situations like that go on all the time for women that work in football. So it was never, from my understanding, from people that know her, I've met her a few times myself, and there's obviously things that, given the industry I work in and the circles I move in, there's things I know that I can't say, which I wish I could. But you can't bake people's confidence like that. It was never about the money. Things like that, the situation that Eva found herself in transpires all the time for anyone who is in football who happens to be the minority. So that's generally women or people of colour. Events like this go on all the time. The only difference is she was brave enough, strong enough, or had the support to take it to court.
But you could argue, and I'm sorry for doing what you criticised me. You said that you didn't do
it
well.
No, it's all right. Same because I disagree.
But John Fearne was in the same situation. He got criticised just as she did, and he got taken off the bench just the same way that she did.
He didn't get called, was it a mother of a whore?
And he was back. He was placed back on the bench weeks after.
He
travelled with the team up to Manchester after they were both demoted.
If Eva never came back. That was the thing. Eva didn't come back. If she'd have come, and I think Jose Mourinho said it in his press conference, if over time, it's a possibility that they can both.
No, but it's not.
No, she didn't want to come back because why should she come back and be demoted for doing her job?
But she wasn't demoted, Tasha. That's my point.
Her job as first team doctor, her role, her tasks as set out in her job description were for her to be on the bench.
No, that's factually inaccurate because she was club doctor before she was on the bench.
She wasn't first team doctor. She had a boss ahead of her.
I don't know whether he was on the bench.
He was.
I don't know. But like I say, it's not essential for a doctor, for a first team doctor to be on the bench. No, it's certainly not essential for them to run on the
bench. It's not essential, but you're missing the point in the... right, okay. So one of the things you said, which really grated with me, was when you're going back and looking at issues, why didn't she talk about them then? Probably because she didn't feel comfortable talking about. I can only talk from, I'm not talking for her. I'm only talking from my personal experience and knowing an experience I went through where I didn't feel comfortable bringing those issues to someone's attention because I knew they wouldn't be dealt with in the correct manner.
So, but do you think not being bought a suit is an issue to bring to a court to say,
is
that's
every
good.
Other member of staff say, but if being born
that's
a suit?
Quite, that's quite trivial, but if you add that to kind of lots of other small trivial things and think, well, all the guys are getting X and I'm not getting
this. But we don't know that was the case.
It's like me saying, it's like me being on a coach with all my employees and stopping for a toilet break, but stopping somewhere that doesn't have a female toilet.
You're making that assumption. We don't know that other people didn't have suits.
No,
as
but
well.
You don't know that they did. So you're assuming, but then chastising me for assuming.
No, I'm not chastising.
What I want to try and get to
is by settling, she clearly had things to say. And if she was really adamant in the conviction of her points that she wanted to kind of put to and against Chelsea, should she not have stood firm and said,
no,
this is not about the money. Yeah. I've got grievances here. I've been treated negatively here. This is sexism. This is X, Y, Z. The money's neither here nor there. You're going to hear how I was treated and I'm going to win in court. Instead, she took the money. Now, it's a lot of money. You give £5 million, a lot of money. Mm. She may look at it like, I might not get another Premier League job for the rest of my life. 5 million could set me up for the rest of my life. That's uncomfortable.
But then we're also forgetting that since the incident at the start of the season, she's been slagged off and abused in the press. Jordan, you would have seen things in the paper.
I think personal stories, sexual stories, and
things that supposedly happened in the club environment. Well, where did they come from? Because I very much doubt she was telling those stories herself. So why should she have to go through another 9 months of being abused just so people don't think it's about the money?
She got the apology that she deserved.
Chelsea had to say on record she did nothing wrong. So professionally, she's come out of this with the same standard that she went into it.
Well, can I address that point, Nash? Because what happened, I mean, I guess I work in employment law. So what tends to happen in these settlement agreements is that there are terms. So one of her terms would have been, she might have actually wrote that apology for Chelsea. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there's nothing that has happened to her that wasn't wrong. Like I said, I agree about the way she was treated initially was bad. I don't think it constituted to sexual discrimination or to constructive dismissal.
Okay.
And I think she had to say those things to get to make the maximum impact to make the most money.
Here's an interesting theory. As we're all people of colour sat here.
Yeah.
And there's all been situations where someone who is not of colour have said, that wasn't racist. and you felt the opposite.
Yeah.
So how can you, as innocent as it may be, say that wasn't sexual discrimination? Because you can't.
Because I'm looking.
You can empathize, but you can't know what I find discriminatory against my gender.
But maybe Natasha, you're possibly attaching some emotion to it. From
I am.
Experience.
I said I was.
Because if you look at the incident itself, she runs off the pitch. John Fern runs off the pitch. He shouts at John. He shouts at her. He shouts at John Fern. He treated them exactly the same. It's consistent with Jose Mourinho behaviour. It isn't.
It is, but isn't the whole issue not just what was happening on the pitch? It's the
prolonged issues over a period of time.
That game.
And it's come to a head.
Behind the scenes that we don't see. That was from what I gleaned.
There's a lot of stuff that isn't in the public domain.
Yeah.
And not just about that particular case, about the way women are treated in football. There's a lot of things that could be said. This case has got prominence because Jose is generally, like you said, a dickhead to everyone. It's not news, and that's why it's got prominence, and because she had the strength to go through the court case. But there's another 50 women out there that aren't brave enough, that aren't strong enough, or they get paid off by their companies in order not to bring this to the public knowledge. Can I say one thing? But because she's a doctor and she has that reputation, she knows she can still work after. If you're a secretary or a presenter, you may not get that grace, and that's why it's easier for her to go to court.
Let me be clear. Like I and you know, I guess working in employment law, I guess I work in human resources. I'm fully aware that, and the reason why I feel so strongly about the Eva Kanyeva situation is because I see people and I see what happens to them, and I see that they don't get justice. Either when I see something like this, and you get paid out £5 million, or allegedly £5 million, let's be clear, it kind of grates on me because these laws were implemented to protect.
Which brings up my final point. What do you think the impact of this and her settling will have on other women in terms of when there are, we don't know if she's lying or telling the truth. We only have her word and Chelsea word. But when the next issue comes up of sexism in football, do you feel the fact that she settled and not seeing this through to the end will have a negative impact on the next woman?
I think for her personally, it's probably going to be, I think we've kind of alluded to, it's probably going to be difficult for her to get another job in football. Not so much because of what happened with Jose. I just think maybe the case after, because at the end of the day,
a bit toxic now.
Yeah, it's a bit toxic. You've said if the main crux of her of the thing was a dispute with Jose. It's difficult to see. I mean, and don't get me wrong, like there may have been things that happened behind the scenes which none of us know about, which haven't been in the media. But what I would say is, you know, why did you seize on that opportunity with Jose to kind of then bring all those things up? You were saying that this was your dream job. So I think it's going to be difficult for her to get another job. And I think it may make it a bit more difficult for women in general, because I think sometimes the sexist person's view and will be like, well, he's had an argument with her, she's taken him to court and...
I can't bother with all that.
And it's a shame. And don't get me wrong, if I actually thought or I knew, and maybe Tasha, you know more than I do, that there actually was a genuine case for sexual discrimination, take it all the way and fleece them. But I don't think it was from what I've seen and what I've heard and what I've read.
Final point, Natasha. Do you think that this will, the way it ended, will make it difficult for the next woman to kind of really bring up any gripes that they're having in football?
It will make no difference, because at the end of the day, the big companies are the one that still have the money and the power to see these kind of cases through, and they know how the law works. But my biggest problem is we can have someone who's convicted of rape or sexual assault get a job in football, but not a woman who feels she was unfairly sacked from her job. Now, that's a bigger problem to me.
I guess Ched Evans might be the conversation for another. Is that where you're going with that?
I'm assuming that's where Natasha's going with that.
His
case has been thrown out, but it hasn't been reheard.
No, it hasn't been reheard. But I mean, I don't believe
he should be at work until the case has been completed. If you were a shopkeeper, I think you're any business would give you paid leave, because I know if that happened in my job, that's what would happen with me.
But effectively, he's done his time.
But he's going on another trial.
He's got another trial to overturn the time that he's...
No, they're rehearing, aren't they?
We're not going to do Chet this week. Anyway. I'm sure it'll pop up another week. But thank you very much, both of you guys, for joining me on this week's special European Championships FFP. There will be, as I mentioned on the last pod a couple of weeks ago, sporadic podcasts throughout the rest of the European Championships. There might be two in a week, there might be one every 2 weeks. But look out for them. Don't forget to subscribe and share. Tell all your friends. Football Fans Podcast. Find us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and follow us on Twitter, FFP_11. Until next time, peace.